other, oh, how long have you been coming here? And I was like, 3 years, you know, and I still haven't met a lot of people.
Sets and have like real significant waves in the ocean. That's something that I miss now. And having warm water in the ocean. And even to be kissed by killer whales at childhood birthday parties. These are just something that when you grow up in San Diego, you grow up with as part of your normal life. And I have, I'm the oldest of three. My brother David and his wife Laura live in Baltimore, and they have one little boy named Miles, who's almost one. My sister and her husband live outside of Minneapolis. They were the H1N1 virus for Halloween. And here's another, like, more dignified picture of them getting married. And this is my family, John and Elena and me. I remember being invited to a church youth group as a pre-teenager and being really eager to learn about God. My family didn't go to church except on holidays, and so I had a lot of questions and was really interested to hear from what that group had to teach me. And then I remember lying in bed when I was about 13 or 14, and it hit me. I need Jesus. I just don't want to live without him in my life. And from that point on, I noticed a difference in my heart, and I knew that something significant had taken place. I was 17, and I had decided to, I'll just leave that. I decided to attend UC Davis. I'd sent in my confirmation of enrollment when I found out that my father was accepting a position within his company to transfer to Maryland. My parents are both from the East Coast, and so it was kind of normal for them to be, for them it felt like moving back home, but for my brother and sister and I, California was the only home that we had ever known. So 2 months after I graduated from high school, I took my mom and dad and brother and sister and our three cats to the airport, and this was when you could go all the way down to the gate and like see people walk actually like down that funny little tunnel. And so they went walking down the funny little tunnel and flew away to Maryland, and I went back to our empty house and like sold our family car to a neighbor. This had been prearranged. My parents didn't like make me do it. And then a week later, I flew to Northern California to start college. And Northern California is very different from Southern California. So I began my new life with no family for thousands of miles. That was kind of weird. In college, I made some good friends and some bad decisions. And I was discipled in my faith and learned about things like quiet time and accountability for the first time. I also faced my first crisis of faith and my first episode of major depression, which lasted for about 2 years. Eventually that ended, and through that battle, although I felt that God was very distant from me, I had also decided that I didn't want anything else but him. Although it was kind of in a snarky sort of way, like where Simon Peter says in John 6, well, Lord, where else will we go? I was kind of like, yeah, God, where else would I go? Sort of like that. But as the depression waned and I started feeling like myself again, I rededicated my life to the Lord, and then I was baptized at that point. So following college, or actually it was during my senior year, but my classes were done, I met my now husband, John. We worked together, and then we were friends outside of work after I no longer worked there, and suddenly all the stars lined up, and it was like, whoa, this is getting interesting. So we got married a million years ago in 1998. And I can joke about this because our marriage, thanks be to God, is awesome. I love this man, even though we memorized our wedding vows, and so he forgot part of it during the ceremony. So he actually left out the part that says, as long as we both shall live. And even though God has used our marriage as an area of sometimes difficult refinement in one another's lives, we're best friends, I think, and we see Jesus in each other. And a word to the wise would be, marry someone that loves Jesus more than you do. And seek to be the right person, not to find the right person. Seek to be the right person. That's free advice. Since then, we have lived in... Really, I think the battery's low. Okay. There it went. Okay. In California, in Arizona, it's a billboard there. I tried to find, and this is from Google Images, these aren't my personal photos, okay? Rhode Island, Boston, that was great. An RV in my husband, John's grandfather's driveway. This is not the actual RV, but pretty much it conveys the idea. Istanbul, Turkey. And Esfahan, Iran, where our daughter Elena was born, and John earned his master's in Iranian history from an Iranian university. And now, New Haven. We live in New Haven now. When Elena was one and we were in the U.S. for a visit, I was diagnosed with several mental disorders, and for the first time, I really pursued medical help. It was eventually successful, for which I'm daily grateful, and I will never take my mental health for granted again. In 2007, we moved to New Haven to work full-time for our nonprofit that we founded in 2006, the year before, called Pathways for Mutual Respect, and for John to do a research fellowship at Yale's Council on Middle East Studies, and later he also began a PhD program, which will also last a million years. So, now a third of my lifetime ago, when I was 24, that story would have taken me hours to tell you. And I have left out some of the details, as you can imagine. But I find it thought-provoking that I can go over all my life in a relatively short amount of time. At times in my journey, I did not think that I would make it. I wasn't sure what that meant. But in the throes of depression, I reached the absolute end of myself. And it seemed that then I was made to stay there at the end of myself for an unbearable amount of time. At this point in my life, the time and the pain, I can say, is relative to the joy and the hope that I have. At the time, the pain seemed interminable, and yet God is not slow in keeping his promises, as some of us, like me, understand slowness. In these weeks of Advent, of waiting and hoping and not being sure of just what lies around the corner, will it be better than we anticipate, or will it be another instance of disappointment? I'd like us to take a minute together to reflect on what it is that you are waiting for right now. In your personal journey, what are you waiting for? Is part of it release from anxiety, healing for a relationship, victory over a nagging sin? Intimacy with God? What are you waiting for? Our text for today is from the Old Testament, a tiny little book that it almost gets lost between the tomes of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the Book of Lamentations. I want to talk about Lamentations in the context of my waiting for relief from my battle against depression, a battle that has lasted most of my adult life. And in fact, I still battle it. But the big difference now is that I almost always win the battle, whereas before I almost always lost the battle. For many years, I waited for delivery and for healing that didn't come or that didn't last. I am the man who has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath. He has driven me away and made me walk in darkness rather than light. Indeed, he has turned his hand against me again and again all day long. He has made my skin and my flesh grow old and has broken my bones. He has besieged me and surrounded me with bitterness and hardship. He has made me dwell in darkness like those long dead. The author of Lamentations, and we think it's the prophet Jeremiah, was an eyewitness to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 586 BC. He saw firsthand the grotesque aftermath of what the Babylonians did, and earlier in the book of Lamentations, he acknowledges that what was happening to the people was not completely undeserved because of their idolatry and their rebellion. In chapter 3, however, this is the chapter, it gets a little more personal, and now the prophet is crying out for mercy, and he hears no reply. "Haven't I been punished enough?" he wants to know. "Okay, I get it. I'm so sorry. Please rescue me." Divine silence. Now the agony intensifies. It's one thing if we know we're suffering due to poor decisions that we've made, or hurtful actions taken by someone else, or bereavement or loss that we're facing. But when we want to get things straight with God, and to that end, we're doing all we can, and we've done all we can, and now we're asking for help, and to hear no reply, and to have no relief, hopelessness can set in. Our hope is set, we think rightly, on the heavenly rescue that we've finally acknowledged that we desperately need, but it doesn't come. Without claiming that I'm like Jeremiah, or maybe I should say without claiming that Jeremiah would understand me, I want to relate my experience with depression as the agonizing waiting time that that was in my life. And I want to explain briefly what I mean by depression. The word depression gets used a lot to mean a lot of different things, from a short-lived sadness to grief associated with a profound loss to a trauma-induced state of mind to a lifelong debilitating mental illness. There's a lot that remains unknown about depression and its causes, and combined with the centuries-old stigma of mental disorders or mental illness, and the fact that all of us experience varying degrees of sadness throughout our lives, it's something that can be hard to define as just one specific thing. So the kind of depression that I experienced, that I'll be referring to today, and that could be rightly categorized as a mental disorder, is a darkness and a hopelessness that pervades nearly every moment of every day for an extended period of time. The symptoms include an inexplicable fatigue, being unable to focus on regular life tasks or work, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, dizziness, confusion about a sense of time, self-doubt, feelings of self-hatred, suicidal thoughts or action, uncharacteristically irrational thoughts, indecisiveness, again, uncharacteristic indecisiveness, change in sleep habits, diminished interest or pleasure in almost all activities, and sudden weight loss or gain. I don't know why my depression got as bad as it did the times that it did, both in college and then later. I can guess that the second time, at least, it was triggered by my postpartum state, and it was probably exacerbated by being isolated in a foreign country and going through a frightening experience of my first pregnancy in a non-English-speaking environment. There were definitely a lot of circumstances, but I'm also not sure that I would have as insistently sought help as insistently as I did if I had not experienced the absence of my coping mechanisms and my all my support networks. One thing about major depression, I believe, is its ruthless unpredictability. You just don't know why or when it's going to come and go. I do believe that God healed me, and to me, it's miraculous. I feel that I went from death to life, and I've been healthy and stably so for about 5 years, so I'm not worried the way I was before that it's going to come back at any time. And in my case, God healed me through a combination of things, including therapy and medication. We are complicated people. We are complicated. I'm thankful to God that a treatment exists that makes being healthy a reality for me. For many long days, months, and years, I waited with admittedly fading hope that I would ever be free of the debilitating symptoms that I was experiencing daily I did not know that much about depression, and so I did not know that it is, for most people, very treatable, although not always easily treatable. All I know was that for me, it wasn't ending. And waiting for something that we know will happen, but we don't know when, is markedly different from waiting for something that we don't, that we have no idea if it will happen. My husband can tell you the story when he was traveling in West Africa, and where we spent a lot of time there in the early part of our marriage. When he was traveling from the bush, which is like not the coast of Africa, to the capital city, Abidjan, it's a trip that by bus takes between 10 and 24 hours, depending what happens on the bus and it breaks down. And this particular day, he chose to take a plane because he needed to get to the capital more quickly. So he caught a taxi in town and told the driver, or in the village, and told the driver what plane he needed to catch. The driver took off over land and field, finally peeling off of the dirt road and into the underbrush, and just like peeling through the underbrush, like into a field. And it was one of those times where, you know, if I were him, I would be thinking, well, I might die here. I mean, you don't know if they're... the guy's like meeting someone out there and they're gonna mug you or, you know, do whatever. But the driver pulled into a sort of like a savanna flat area and he just stopped. There's no one around, there's nothing in sight. It's been miles since they got off like the nearest road. So John, my husband, asks if he's sure that this is the place. And the driver said, yeah, this is the place. And so John, he insists, and so my husband pays and the driver drives off. So my husband is standing in the middle of the jungle in Africa. No GPS, no cell phone service, nothing. He has no idea where he is or even how to get back to the nearest dirt road. He can't do anything but wait. He waited till over an hour after the scheduled departure time of the plane. Then, suddenly he hears the noise of a pickup truck, and it comes barreling into the clearing, and two men jump out of the back and grab a folding table, and they pop it open on the grass. Someone else jumps out of the truck and puts a tarp up over the table for shade. Somebody else gets out with a metal folding chair, puts it down, someone sits in it. Hello, how may I help you? So John goes over to the table. The driver was right. This is the airport. And he checks in to his flight at this new folding table. And sure enough, here comes the propeller plane, makes a landing in the clearing, and by that time there's a few more passengers there, and they all check in. They get on the plane, and off it goes for Abidjan, the capital. This is an example of really not knowing if something is going to happen. Is the plane going to come or not? Will I have to sleep out here? Am I going to die out here or walk trying to find the road? Fortunately, it is not so with our Heavenly Father. We may not know the details and we don't understand His timing. We can't predict the health of our spouse or our parents, or our children. We do know that there will be suffering in this life. We will experience pain. It's universal. Most of us will, at some point, experience a crushing grief that presses us beyond what we think we want to or can bear. But it's different because a new day will dawn. We just don't know when. The prophet Jeremiah continues, "He has walled me in so I cannot escape. He has weighed me down with chains. Even when I cry out for help, he shuts out my prayer. He has barred my way with blocks of stone. He has made my paths crooked. Like a bear lying in wait, like a lion in hiding, he dragged me from the path and mangled me and left me without help. He drew his bow and made me the target for his arrows. He pierced my heart with arrows from his quiver. I became the laughingstock of all my people. They mock me in song all day long. He has filled me with bitter herbs and sated me with gall." The prophet is graphically illustrating the mental, physical, and spiritual anguish that he's experiencing during his agonizing wait for rescue. He sees God as his adversary, making it more difficult for him than it has to be. And when he begs for relief, when he does all that he knows how to do spiritually, prayer and so on, he feels that he is scorned and offered bitter things that make him feel even worse than before. "He has broken my teeth with gravel. He has trampled me in the dust. I have been deprived of peace. I have forgotten what prosperity is. So I say, my splendor is gone and all that I had hoped from the Lord." My splendor is gone, says the prophet. All I've worked for, all I thought I had reason to believe I had achieved, or that I had reason to believe I had access to or had a right to have. Not only that, but all I had hoped from the Lord is gone. The past makes no sense, the present is calamitous, and all hopes for the future have been swept away. Here, the prophet has reached a crossroads. His faith and all that he has staked his life on is hanging in the balance. Will he be swept away by the bitterness? Or will he hold on a bit longer and risk even greater devastation? And this is the turning point of the book. "I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope." And I'm gonna stop there, even though it's the middle of a sentence, and just reiterate that this is the turning point of this lament. Far from forgetting or being over what happened, the prophet acknowledges the pain and the suffering of the recent past, even though he's still in a dark season of the soul. And probably with great effort, I suspect, he calls to mind something that gives him hope. What do you have to call to mind to regain your hope in the Lord? When all of the shaken things no longer matter, when only what cannot be shaken remains, what do you call to mind? For me, it was the crisis of faith and the deep depression that I'd experienced during my college years and the memory that I had come out of that. I didn't understand why, I didn't understand how, but I recalled, even though at times angrily or bitterly, God was good to me in the end. He was faithful to me. His faithfulness I was certain of after it was all over. And that kept me from perishing during my second episode of major depression. It kept me from sinking beneath where I could breathe. I still felt that I was in quicksand. I still had no idea. I couldn't imagine what form rescue would possibly take at that point. And I felt that years of my life were being sapped from me. But I had that memory of God's faithfulness. This is what the prophet calls to mind to give him hope. "Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail." This is going to sound familiar. We know this verse. We don't memorize the first part of it. "They are new every morning. His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness." During my deepest depression, one day at church, a lady that I didn't even know rushed up to me, and she knew that we had been overseas, and she asked me to tell her something amazing that God had done. I know what she wanted to hear. But I said what was honest, and that was that I survived. I'm here. And I could tell it was not what she wanted to hear. She expected something spiritual, some story of revival or of some miracle. But my victory, even though at the time it didn't even feel like that to me, was that I had survived. I had not been consumed. It was a long, dark, and freezing cold season of winter in my spiritual life. There weren't any beautiful blossoms and sunshine I could point to as evidence of God's work or his involvement in what I was going through. Just that I was still here, and I had his promises to me from Jeremiah 17, which is like one of my life verses. Blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him. He will be, or she will be, like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when heat comes. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. It continues, the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? That's exactly how I felt. And furthermore, it seems at this point that the prophet is beginning to see the larger canvas of God's purposes. He is calling to mind things that give him reason to hope that no matter how bad it gets on this side, from our perspective, from his perspective, there is something beautiful and completely unexpected. It has to be completely unexpected because everything that we have expected has not happened. If we can just hang in there a little while longer. And waiting is not always passive, but we don't always feel like we're making progress. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. Do we want God? Do we consider God our portion? Do we want someone else's portion? I always think of that. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in him, to the one who seeks him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man to bear the yoke while he is young. Now, here's something I think, too, that God is pointing us to. While he is young implies that he will be old someday. It implies hope. It implies a future. In allowing us to pass through the valley of the shadow of death, God is transforming us and is also developing in us an ability to minister to others in a way that we could not if we had not gone through what we just did, or what we are. If I have lived under a deep depression for years and years and I meet someone and they say, oh, I know what you mean, I felt that way once. Well, really, for how long? 2 days? It was horrible. And I'm not to minimize the intensity of someone's pain, or the reality of the difficulty, but there are different ways that God is gonna use us because of the different experiences that he gave us. Let him sit alone in silence, for the Lord has laid it on him. Let him bury his face in the dust. There may yet be hope. There is hope. Let him offer his cheek to the one who would strike him. Let him be filled with disgrace. These things pass away. Men are not cast off from the Lord forever. Though he brings grief, he will show compassion. So great is his unfailing love. For he does not willingly bring affliction or grief to the children of men. This is something that we ought to weigh, how deeply we consider that truth to have taken root in our lives. Do we believe that God does not willingly bring affliction or grief to us? And that he will not cast us off forever? That he will show compassion? So, life is hard. We are complicated people. God is invisible. And there may be a time in our lives when he seems distant or absent for an extended time. Because he knows us better than we even know ourselves, He doesn't always rescue us in the way that we hope or in the timing that we want. Today, I knew that I wasn't gonna come here to give you a pep talk or tell you the right spiritual things to do to hasten the passing of suffering. You already know all of those, and they're not bad to do. I'm not going to give you what might be a possibly false hope that involves some kind of immediate gratification, because I have a sense that you do not want to settle for that anyway. I think that you know deep down that you want God to draw you closer than you've ever been before. I think you want a hope that endures, a peace that transcends, and a love that holds out to see the tender face of God. The prophet Jeremiah reminds us that even if the past seems wasted, the present is unmanageable, and the future looks hopeless, each of us has something we can call to mind, and therefore we can have hope, a seed. It can be as small as a seed. And that will give us the hope that we need to wait quietly, to sit in silence, to bear the yoke. Doesn't necessarily mean passively. I can tell you from my experience, because I have been through a fire. It was not pleasant at the time, and it was not a gracious or a pretty sight. I chafed and writhed under my suffering because I saw the frailty of my faith and the fickleness of my heart. But God promises, and I can testify to this with my life, that He Himself will restore us and make us strong, firm, and steadfast after we have suffered a little while. You will see God's hand, you will see His mercy, and you will see His love for you. And it's when we accept God's call into a deeper relationship with Him, the kind that can only be wrought through a suffering, that we find that He is able to use us in whole new ways for His purposes and for His glory.